Good evening. For this, the third lecture in the series, we've come to Bristol, to the IMAX Theatre, built in the city's harbourside development. It's a place dedicated to the art of communication in the 21st century, and as such, it's exactly the right setting for tonight's lecture. The title is The Rhetoric That Binds and Blinds, the argument that language can stoke the flames of bigotry and conflict in a climate of fear. Words matter to our lecturer. He's a poet and playwright and winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. During the 2 years he was imprisoned in Nigeria, much of it in solitary confinement, he used pilfered scraps of paper to jot down his thoughts. It was, he wrote later, all that kept him sane. Since then, he's been a fierce campaigner for the rights of artists, authors and journalists to tell the truth as they see it, without fear. Will you please welcome, ladies and gentlemen, our Wreath Lecturer 2004, Wole Soyinka.
Thank you very much. I propose to address this topic from two directions. One, the political. The other, the religious. However, in many parts of the world, and indeed for far too long in history, both proved to be merely two sides of a spinning coin whose trajectory is the control of human lives, in short, power. We only need to observe the sanctimoniousness that often characterizes one, the political, and the sacrosanctity that is claimed as the foundation of the other, the religious, even when it extends its constituency to the political and mundane. A religious leader whips up his citizens in a frenzy of fear, whose tenor is that their very existence, and only incidentally that of the state, is threatened. In the hysterical condition that is aroused in the populace, hundreds of youths are legally sentenced to be hanged for the crime of being agents of Satan, enemies of God, etc., etc. On the other side, the political, an elected president launches a war, declaring that no matter what the rest of the world thinks, his nation is merely serving God's will. The coupling within for God and country is no historic accident. Let me at this point call attention to the fact that hysteria is not always loud and violent. In fact, there is the quiet form of hysteria, as medical experts will testify. Hysteria can also manifest itself as a collective and infectious outbreak, one that cannot always be accurately traced to a logical causative event. Many here will remember that leftist phase of the 60s, labeled Trotskyite, or Maoist, one that is now being superseded by other radical notions towards the transformation of man, society, and environment, such as ecophilia, empathy with nature as the beginning of wisdom. The sometimes rabid phase of the radical rhetoric of the left is a phase that is now receding into obscurity, thanks mostly to the collapse of communist ideology. I happen to believe that the humanistic foundation of the socialist idea has not thereby been invalidated, but let us leave that to another discourse. The period that I wish to recall was characterized by the exploits of the Red Brigade, based largely in Italy, Action Directe in France, the Bader-Meinhof in Germany, with clones in Latin America and Japan, in addition to one or two isolated spots in Asia. Perhaps the most sensational single event of that period was the kidnapping and murder of the former Italian Prime Minister Aldo Moro. The famous youth-inspired 1968 uprising in Paris that attempted to resurrect a commune modeled after the Paris Commune of the French Revolutionary Ferment was another notable manifestation of the passion for change, a severe testing of the status quo, and very French in temper, despite its continental affiliations. Names like Red Danny, Con Bent, Régis Debray, Angela Davis enter the lore of world revolutionary gladiators. Depending on which arc of the class spectrum one occupied, and the methodology of action that they advanced and deployed, the overall movement evoked among the world population extreme degrees of admiration, revulsion, and fear. How wide would the movement spread, especially among youth? How deeply would it undermine the fabric of society? This, then, was a setting for a far less sensational but widely diffused offshoot of the same cast of mind, the junior partners, if you like, that had sprung up within the radical atmosphere of the 60s. It is the extract from this largely unfocused, non-lethal offshoot that I wish to identify as typifying the nature of rhetoric that, in various degrees of flippancy and adolescent conviction, can graduate over time into an agenda for unreflective extremism, building up to a hysterical level that turns an otherwise rational section of humanity into active instruments of, at the very least, a mandatory suspension of rationality. A complacent society views the new tendency at first with condescending amusement, later with trepidation. I came to observe this process at first hand was just as relevant to my observations. I was in self-imposed exile, a therapy I had embarked upon from another situation of lethal rhetoric that had sacrificed a million or two of Nigerian humanity under the rhythmic mantra, to keep a nation one is a task that must be done. Our civil war was being concluded in a mood of euphoria, and as I emerged from prison detention, I was not sure which form of this hysteria I found more unnerving. The tone of nationalist jingoism that surrounded me before I was locked up, one that made that war inevitable in the first place, or the barely suppressed triumphalist smugness into which I was thrust as I regained my freedom. Military success was equated with the divine vindication of the war. On the other side, the breakaway Biafran state, the same syndrome had more tragic results. Youths went into battle with nothing but wooden guns in their hands, captives of the emotive rhetoric that was drummed daily into their heads. No power on the African continent can subdue us. That belief had somehow translated into the mimic guns with which they charged the federal foe, as reported by a colleague who was himself numbed by the experience. Was it any different, I wondered, from the self-submission of normally hard-headed men and women to the rhetorical powers of a Ugandan, Alice Lakwena, and her lord's army? Alice's volunteers charged into hails of bullets, convinced that their force was neutralized from the inoculation that Alice had administered. After her capture in Tanzania, a university professor who had been part of our army was asked in an interview how it was possible for him, a man of presumed intellect, to have been persuaded of the supernatural powers of this woman, and for so long. He could proffer no answer, suggesting only that they had all fallen under some spell. Fatalities were rationalized away, such victims were only weak in faith. This scenario has been sadly encountered in many more civil war zones all over the continent, most especially among child soldiers. And now we come to the leftist mantra. As I began my lecture tour of some European universities during that exile, it did not take long for me to realize that the mood of the historic Paris uprising was still in the ascendant, never mind the failure of that movement, and perhaps the indoctrinating zeal was all that was left. I came into daily contact with students and all manner of disenchanted youths seeking a revolutionary answer to the oppressive contradictions of their societies. Maoists, Maoist-Leninists, Trotskyites, Maoist-Leninists, Trotskyites, Stalinist-Leninists, etc., etc. No matter what hyphenated tendencies they professed, all had one fundamental trait in common. They saw themselves as bearers of a new illumination on the condition and future of human society. They formed a compact of solidarity with the marginalized, no matter how remotely placed, from the bauxite mines of Jamaica to the coal mines of South Africa. Ideologically schooled in Marxism, they gave a practical anarchic demonstration of the cue they had elicited from Karl Marx's analysis of law. Law was not neutral, but was an instrument to protect the interests of the ruling classes. In a class struggle, therefore, which was their avowed mission, law itself was to be repudiated. As for wealth, where did wealth emanate but from the exploitation of man by man, proven by the immoral profit from the surplus labor of others? Thus, their favorite slogan declared quite simplistically that all property is theft. That slogan was put into practice in any number of ways, from the merely self-dramatizing gesture to the socially disruptive, once it was placed in tandem with Marxist interpretation of law, which could now be taken as advocating its own overthrow through anarchic conduct. Observe this pattern of direct action at work, most notably in Frankfurt University. A student who took a parked bicycle, motorbike, or motor car that belonged to another did not consider it an act of theft. He kept it and returned it at his leisure, or for as long as it took him to acquire a more attractive or convenient one. Libraries bewailed their helplessness as students took away books and never returned them, often returning to exercise their right to borrow some more. Students felt quite noble in raiding the accounts of parent or guardian, or indeed the neighborhood store. All property is theft, and that, take note, included intellectual property. In short, plagiarism was no crime. It was an infectious, but only mildly dangerous eruption of the rhetorical hysteria that overtook intelligent minds all over the world, one that was characterized by a unidimensional approach to multiple faces of reality, however varied or self-contradicting. The most dangerous of these catchphrases, however, one that was just as blithely but vicariously tossed around by the student population at the time, but has surely resurfaced in the minds of many of us in contemporary times, was, "There are no innocents." Yes, we heard it even then. That 60s mood of extreme militancy, its repudiation of all bourgeois morality, a natural proceeding, of course, from the logic of the proclaimed self-serving interests of law, led remorselessly to the tacit, sometimes loudly trumpeted, endorsement of acts of sabotage, kidnapping, and even murder. At the time, the self-willed hysteria was induced by a deliberate exercise of blinding the mind to other considerations, screaming doubts into silence. Alas, the sermonizers of universal guilt in our time are not the student cafeteria crowd or the Sunday afternoon rhetoricians of London's Hyde Park Corner. Unlike those students, they are not creatures of uncertainty, but of holy conviction. And they have demonstrated again and again that they consider their lives of the greatest value when they expend it, not even accidentally, but in a deliberate act as the ultimate consummation of that conviction. They belong to a most select, near impenetrable community. There are no innocents. The accentuation of the earlier rhetoric, "all property is theft," is what marks the difference between the rhetorical hysteria that held the world in thrall in those fervid 60s and 70s, on the one hand, and the nature of what assails us today. Merge those two shorthand rhetorical triggers, and we arrive at the zone of gospelin that claims that all life is theft, and thus may be restored to its legitimate owner by any true believer, and as rapidly as possible. If only we could persuade the apostles of such gospels of the infinite virtue of modesty that resides in leaving such restoration to the personal intervention of the divine proprietor. Alas, they have constituted themselves into agents of restitution, where innocents pay sudden forfeit without even the consolation of first seeking divine forgiveness for the lamentable lapse of being alive. The question we must now confront is this: who or what are the principal agents of the season of rhetorical hysteria that now seeks to bind and blind the world within our climate of fear? We need a lot of objectivity and a commitment to equitable dealing in addressing this question. Fortunately, but what a costly piece of fortune, the world has received a most exemplary piece of instruction in the devastating potential of a condition that can spread and infect a whole nation. For this, we must thank the president of one of the most powerful nations of the world, the United States. For an intense period that began over a year ago, our airwaves were bombarded with an entrapment piece of monologue of just four words: weapons of mass destruction. It was a sustained demonstration, both as metaphor and as prophecy, of how empty such rhetoric can prove, yet how effectively it can blind the people, lead them into a cul-de-sac, securing nearly an entire nation within a common purpose that proves wrongly premised. Outside that nation itself, more than a few others were swept up in the hysteria that was stimulated by no more than the simple but passionate evocation of that mantra, weapons of mass destruction. Predictably, it was only a matter of time before it acquired an acronym, WMD, either for ease of reference or perhaps as a relief for that uncooperative mantra that stubbornly refused to manifest its name. WMD aspired to the level of religious faith. Individuals who disputed its assigned reality found themselves subjected to abuse, sometimes of a violent nature. Both overtly and indirectly, unbeliever nations were either offered inducements or threatened with sanctions. The hysteria that was inspired by that presidential monologue was most bemusing. It reminded many of the McCarthy period of anti-communist hysteria, where the mere failure to denounce the communist ideology with satisfactory fervor or to denounce one's colleagues for communist sympathies became an unpatriotic act that was sometimes accounted treason. Thus came into being the damning tag un-American activities to ferret out and punish which a standing committee was set up in the United States legislature. Was there any difference between that rhetorical device of the mid-50s and that of the turn of the last century? Certainly, there was continuity. And as if to ensure that the nation co-option that fed on the rhetoric of the enemy within did not lack for nourishment, the intervening decades between un-American activities and weapons of mass destruction were injected with holding devices in the nature of evil empire and latterly axes of evil. The beauty of the political mantra has always been its ability to distill complex events and global relationships into a rhetorical broth that precludes digestion but guarantees satisfaction. Let no one underestimate the monstrosity of September 11, 2001, that arrogant manifestation of the mantra, there are no innocents, nor its hideous impact on global consciousness. The tasteless gloating of some normally astute writers and intellectuals whose will to radicalism sometimes overpowers their humanism is only a measure of the pretentious detachment of some of us from the world we live in. It should not be permitted to cloud our natural revulsion over that event, any more than that it should inhibit us from interrogating the choices of response that could be expected from the leadership of a stricken people. More than sufficient time has elapsed for objective considerations of the choices, with all due allowance made for the fact that it was that space, not ours, that was most directly affected, most deeply traumatized, most directly injected with the virus of fear. There were options, however, and the case is being made here that the leadership of that nation chose to substitute for a hard assessment of its relationship with the rest of the world an emotive rhetoric that blinded it even further, driving that nation deeper into an isolationist monologue, even within the debating chambers of the United Nations. The increasing unilateralism of the United States government since that monster's date, most certainly in the invasion of Iraq, aided by its coalition of the willing, has fed directly into and widened the climate of fear. We've watched and listened in recent times to unedifying, indeed petulant, acts and pronouncements of a nation that is clearly not accustomed to being contradicted. It amounted to an act of heresy for nations not to believe in WMD, just as once upon a time American citizens were hounded for failing to believe that there was one communist hiding under the bed in every household. The hysterical monologue of one nation reigned supreme, demanding that the rest of the world be bound in it and follow its direction blindfold. There are moments, admittedly, when the imperatives of dialogue appear to be foreclosed. Nevertheless, we must never stop contrasting the dangers of monologue with the creative potential of dialogue, the latter holding out a chance of contracting, if not completely dissipating, our climate of fear. Certainly, such an exercise can slow down the division of the world into two irreconcilable camps and hopefully prevent it altogether. Fortunately, a global awareness of this perilous condition is not totally absent, and thus a positive note on which to end, invoking the lessons in contrast between two figures who may be held to embody the two polarities, monologue and dialogue. Both figures, as it happens, are products of the same history, culture, and nation state. I now invite you to accompany me to a milestone event that took place at the very end of the last century in the United Nations, with symbolic timing for that end of the century, an event that declared in ringing terms that it was time to eschew the sterile monologues of the past and cultivate a new spirit of dialogue, the only prescription that the world knows for the hysterical affliction of the rhetorical. It was within the United Nations that the yet ongoing project titled Dialogue of Civilizations was launched by President Khatami of Iran in association with UNESCO, a project that has already begun to sprout several national and regional offshoots. I was present at the elaborate inauguration in the UN headquarters in New York, attended by several heads of state, other world leaders, intellectuals, ministers of religion, etc., etc. On that occasion, President Khatami delivered a most enlightened speech, one that I'm certain took his audience by surprise. On the minds of most of that audience, including mine, was unquestionably the fact that we were listening to the leader of that very nation, whose late spiritual leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, not quite a decade earlier, had inaugurated an era of global fear by unilateral appropriation of judicial rights over any citizen of our world, as he sentenced the writer, Salman Rushdie, to death for an alleged offense against his religion, a major religion deservedly classified as one of the world's religions, but just the same, only one of the structures of transcendental intimations or superstitions known as religion. The consequences of that moment are still very much with us. A dismal instance within my own country, Nigeria, was that of the governor of a largely Muslim state, Zamfara, who pronounced a killing fatwa on a young journalist. Her crime, a comment that the Prophet Muhammad did not lack an eye for beauty in womanhood. Such religious arrogation would never have been dared within our secular nation before the emboldening example of the Ayatollah Khomeini. The Ayatollah's moment of a global incitement to murder remains a poisoned watershed in the relationship between and within nations. It has contributed to a large extent to the very condition of global intolerance, bigotry, and sectarian violence, to whose dismantling an elected Iranian leader now openly committed himself, and most symbolically, in the halls of the United Nations. That past was unquestionably one of the gathering moments of the violent winds that have swept the world into the zone of fear that becomes more heated by the day. Khatami's challenge to the world has been taken up in various places, in Georgia, for instance, in Macedonia. I participated in another in Abuja, Nigeria, in December last year, the scene of a religion-instigated massacre that stunned the world in its mindlessness and ferocity, one whose spurious provocation was the staging of a Miss World contest and its alleged female immodesty. Now, within the cult of political correctness, itself an immobilizing form of hysteria, this constitutes, I know, a delicate, near untouchable subject. I do not share such a sentiment. There is nothing in the least delicate about the slaughter of innocents. One of my all-time favorite lines of poetry comes from the black American poet Langston Hughes. It reads very simply, "There is no lavender word for lynch." Now, that is one line I would not mind converting to the service of rhetorical hysteria. We encounter a reluctance to question why today, more than ever, as I remarked in an earlier lecture, adherents of some religions, more than others, turn the pages of their scriptures into a divine breath that fans the random homicidal spore to all corners of the world. Political correctness forbids the question, but for the rest of us who prefer politically incorrect truthfulness to politically correct incineration or other forms of complicity in our premature demise, this question continues to exercise our minds. Just what is it that turns the mantra of a beatific chant of faith in one religion more than the next into summons to an orgy of death? Why did Martin Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ arouse violent reactions, condemnations, and incitement to boycott, as has recently Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ, but not a universal outcry for the murder of the cineasts or of those who participated in these interpretative exercises? The fault is not in religion, but in the fanatic of every religion. Fanaticism remains the greatest carrier of the spores of fear and the rhetoric of religion, with the hysteria it so readily generates is fast becoming the readiest killing device of contemporary times. Even after half a century, films that touch upon the era of Nazi glorification, with their orchestrated chant of Sieg Heil, continue to send a chill of apprehension down the spines of all with a historical memory. Scenes of mass religious frenzy increasingly resurrect these nightmares, and if President Khatami's inspired dialogue of civilizations leads eventually to a dissociation of the chant of millions to the greatness of God from the gross ultra-nationalist politics lodged in the chant of Sieg Heil, we would have lifted one corner, a not inconsiderable one, off the shrouds of fear that now envelop life and humanity. Thank you very much.
Professor Schwerinka, thank you very much indeed. So the mantra of WMD is as dangerous as those that incited the Bolsheviks and the would-be revolutionaries of the 60s. Dialogue is preferable to monologue, but how can you be sure in a climate of fear and violence that you're in dialogue with people who are truly representative? Those are some of the questions that Wale Schwerinka has raised in this, his third lecture, but what are the questions that you would like to ask? I'd like to invite our audience here in Bristol to put some questions now. Who's going to be our first questioner? Gentleman there.
Alistair, I'm a student. You say the Bush administration considers it heresy not to believe in WMD. McCarthy had heretics imprisoned or on occasion executed. Bin Laden simply blows them up. Now, considering two of Bush's fiercest critics, the playwright and actor Tim Robbins and the filmmaker Michael Moore, far from being exiled, imprisoned or executed, both live in multi-million dollar apartments, both have won Oscars during the Bush administration. So for all the parallels you've drawn tonight between Bush, McCarthy and Bin Laden, my question is this: can you really not tell the difference?
I'm sure I can, and I'm sure we all can. But both different personalities and mentalities happen to meet at a certain point. I feel religiously inspired, watch George Bush's language, read his State of the Nation address in January this year, the conviction that a religious impulse, a divinely inspired impulse, justifies even obvious untruths. And of course, the main issue is that if a certain path is followed that leads to destruction, whether that path emanates from a democratic area or from a theocracy or even from what I call the quasi-state, it's our responsibility as citizens to be concerned.
But the response to the heresy surely is entirely different and marks out a great ideological divide between McCarthy and Bin Laden and Bush on the other hand.
Well, if you consider the number of innocents, because I'm talking about destruction now, I'm talking about the killing of innocents as a result of a particular route being taken and being justified by divine conviction. Those who've been killed, and please, I'm not being glib at all about this, people of all ages, sexes, innocent people, even those who've suffered under that other monster, Saddam Hussein, and who did not mind being liberated. But the form of liberation is very important, and the lies which are told to the world for that particular methodology, these matter to us. So when we empathizing in a very deep, humane way with victims of, let us say, Osama bin Laden, we have to consider also the victims of those who are the result of a particularly atrocious route which was taken and based on very wrong premises.
Lady there.
Madge Dresser, University of the West of England. I, too, lived through the McCarthy era and the more recent era of the weapons of mass destruction. And I do remember that those who were the most courageous in resisting McCarthy often were the ones who really didn't want to see what Stalin was doing as well. And until 1956 or so, there was a kind of blind spot there. And I also wonder if you think that there is a kind of reluctance to engage in a full rational debate on the part of some of the anti-war group, because I was told by a reputable scientist that many of the biological weapons could be put on the back of the truck. How do we know that they're not in Syria? We can think that Bush is corrupt and venal, and no doubt, well, I don't want to get charged with libel, but, you know, he may well be. But still, given Saddam Hussein's record, given his boast that he wanted to rain poison gas on Tel Aviv, given the fact that these weapons are eminently transportable, and a very poisonous ideology is around. How are we so sure that there aren't any weapons of mass destruction?
Yeah. First of all, let me take your indictment of the intellectuals of that period. I was a student here at the time, and I agree with you 100% also about the failures of the radical left, all of us, you know, in that sense. Now, the second part of your question, are there weapons of mass destruction? Were there weapons of mass destruction there? What is important for us, since we're not scientists, we're not on the spot, is that there were inspectors approved by the United States herself, inspectors who had the authority, the moral authority, and the scientific know-how. And they had been selected and sent there by the United Nations. Bush did not allow them to complete their work. There was a period when the defiance of the United Nations by Saddam Hussein was such that would definitely have justified action, collective, not unilateral action, by the United Nations. But that period passed. The man said, okay, come in, I give up. And then that is when Bush said the inspector should get out.
But is there,
that's an immoral action.
But is there never a time for action? I mean, isn't there a point when non-action becomes appeasement?
Ah, okay. Let me give you an example when action definitely was justifiable. Afghanistan. America was attacked in peacetime. America was attacked. America did its work together with the United Nations. The culprits were identified. The backing regime was identified. And a coalition, which was authorized, at least approved by the United Nations, moved to winkle out the malefactors. Now, for me, this is an act of self-defense. I have no problem at all with that.
Gentleman here on the front row.
Tariq Modood, University of Bristol. It was pleasing to be reminded of Marxist terrorism a few decades ago at a time when blind extremism is only identified with Muslims across the world. And it's, of course, heartening to know that that terrorism passed away. And therefore, perhaps we can look forward to something similar about the terrorism today. So I'd quite like to ask what you think led to the demise of that earlier episode of terrorism. I mean, was it dialogue? Was it something else? And can we learn from that for what's happening today?
I think that's several factors led to the demise of that terrorism. First of all, there was some very solid police work, but there was also an even more important factor. There was an economic boom which turned some of the radicals of that period into, shall we say, bourgeois competitors. Red Danny is now a member of the Green Party. He's chosen a very different path.
But you want to know, sir, if there are any lessons for us today in this?
Yes, well, I think that perhaps a very important reason that the previous terrorism faded away is that the people for whom the terrorists said they were acting, you know, workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains, did not respond to that call. So the terrorists were not seen to be speaking for a larger cause or a larger movement. And I think that's very relevant today, because some of the policies, including the ones that you've mentioned in your lecture, some of the policies are at the moment creating a polarization between Muslims and non-Muslims, whereas really a more clever policy is to isolate the terrorists, not to force other Muslims into somehow supporting them or acquiescing and saying, yes, well, they are speaking for Islam.
I agree, absolutely. Today, the policy of isolating the terrorists is a very important one. And this is where countries like the United States sometimes make mistakes. The actions being undertaken by the United States, such as the invasion of Iraq, for instance. And again, I have to qualify this, because we all know that some Arab countries were actually happy to see Saddam Hussein go, right? But the process of liberating, quote-unquote, Iraq was one that also got the back of a number of Arab and Islamic nations up. They said, this country is being pounded by America, that is, by the West, without the authority of the United Nations, the one body to which everybody belongs. And that made people ask, wait a minute, who is next? Who within the axis of evil is next?
Of course, but what about the pursuit of Osama bin Laden himself? I mean, you give America some points on that. You do believe it's doing the right thing in pursuing him.
Listen, Nigerians died as a result of the bombing of the World Towers. Christians, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, this was a crime against humanity. It was not just a crime against the United States, it was a crime against humanity. And it flouted the provisions, the purpose of the United Nations.
Gentleman there, yes.
I'm Chris Cowley from the Western Daily Press, based in Bristol. And I just wondered whether, I mean, over the last couple of years, we've looked at the United Nations and felt that perhaps they're a gutless organisation. I wondered whether you felt there was a future for the United Nations.
Yeah, it's a very good question, one which, frankly, puts me sometimes on the spot. United Nations has been weakened in many ways by some failures. But it is weakened further when nations, powerful nations like the United States, act in a unilateral way, and especially a unilateral way which goes against the will of the body itself. So if the United Nations is weak today, one of the contributory nations to that frailty is the United States. But I do not give up on the United Nations for the simple reason that there's nothing else at the moment to cling to. And if everybody goes their own way, we especially, the weaker nations, the third world, will be run over in many instances by the more powerful nations.
I think, ladies and gentlemen, on that note, we really have to let Professor Schoenke have a rest at last. Thank you all very much indeed. Next week we'll be at the University of Leeds for the fourth lecture in the series, and that will be entitled The Quest for Dignity, in which Wale will suggest an equitable way forward in the conflict in the Middle East, the region at the very heart, he says, of today's climate of fear. I hope you'll join us then. In the meantime, thank you very much to our audience here at the IMAX Theatre in Bristol, and our thanks to the Reith Lecturer 2004, Wale Schoenke.